Hello world, this is Allison Pipitone. This is where we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. I believe I met Catherine Cook around 1996. It was in the summer, and Michael Meldrum told me I had to get down the street to this new coffee place called Spot Coffee and check out this band called Redheaded Stepchild. So I went down there, and I heard that voice, and I said, oh my goodness, that girl can sing. She's a great songwriter. She's got an amazing history in the past 20 years doing music. I want to hear a lot about it, and I want you to also get to know my good friend, Catherine Cook. Hi, Catherine.
Hey, Al.
Did I get everything right on the introduction?
That was close, considering how many millions of years ago that was. It was the Topic Cafe.
Oh, the Topic.
It was not Spot. Not that there's anything wrong with Spot.
Well, there's some of the same letters. There's
That's true.
All of the same except the S. There's a T, an O, and a P.
That's true.
It was missing the S.
So the Topic Cafe was, I believe, the first real coffee shop kind of place in Buffalo. It predated Spot, I believe.
God.
Yeah.
So we have known each other since before coffee shops.
That's a long time.
Or since the first coffee shop.
That's true.
I don't know if it was the first in the world or just America.
It was before the Starbucking of America, for sure.
Starbucking of America. Catherine, help yourself to a beer, okay?
All right, I have a beer. I mean, I guess it's a beer. It's technically a flavored malt beverage, but
it's good in this hot summer, beautiful day here in Buffalo, New York. Okay, guess what I want to start with?
I couldn't begin to guess.
I want to start with this because I looked up some facts on you. You're going to like this. First of all, which I could share this picture online if we want, there are two other Catherine Cooks that I know of.
Yes.
This one I called today, and she picked up, but I got scared and I hung up on her. She lives somewhere in the Midwest, and she's a principal private risk management consultant, and there's her phone number.
Oh, wow.
She's in, I think, Iowa.
I like her hair.
Catherine Cook, you should get one of those haircuts.
I think so, too.
Do you want to go to the
Let's go do that after we're done here.
Okay, yeah. Perfect. Unless you like this haircut better. This Catherine Cook lives in New York City.
Oh, well, look at her.
She is an investment banker.
So that's a different direction I could have gone
in. Could have gone insurance, investing.
I think there's also a Catherine Cook who's like a microbiologist.
Oh, dude, that's good.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
All your alter egos.
Yeah. Do you think that they wish that they were folk singers?
Well, I can tell you there's another Allison Pipitone, and I asked her that exact question. And she said no. she went to Harvard, and she was a diver. She dived on the Harvard swim team.
So she doesn't need no stinking rock and roll.
Well, I asked her if I could tell people I went to Harvard, and she could tell people she has 9 CDs, and she did not respond.
Oh.
But we're going to try with these two Catherine Cooks.
Okay.
I'll let you take these home if you want.
Okay.
Okay. So, but what I have here is lyrics for one of your songs. Now, I know plenty of your songs, and I know so many of them are good, but literally this is, when this one popped up, I go, oh, I love this song. I just want to read some of the lyrics.
Okay.
And I want to just talk about, we don't have to talk about why you wrote it or anything. We can if you want, but I'd rather talk about the songwriting itself.
Okay.
How do you, because your words are really cool. I love the way you work the words, and I want to talk about that. Okay. So I'm just going to read this.
Okay.
And it's called See You Again.
Okay.
You lit my cigarette. You stole my lighter. You overserved me. Then you cut me off. You said you loved me. You called a cab for me. But I know I'll never see you again. You brought me ice cream. You brought me cocaine. You took me dancing. And you slept with my friends. You said you loved me. You held my hair back. But I know I'll never see you again. Goes to the chorus, another verse I want to read. I made you breakfast when I wasn't hungry. I walked your dog and I scratched your guitars. I said I loved you. I betrayed my best friends for you. I know I'll never see you again. You sent me postcards, but you burned my letters. You took my pride, but you wrote me a song. You really love me. You still buy me whiskey, but I know I'll never see you again. Now, listen, some of my favorite songs are image-driven songs.
Mm-hmm.
The images in that are just beautiful. And I'm going to guess those are just actually mostly real things, right?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, as a songwriter, there's embellishments. I mean, some of those things were things that, like, happened that were inconsequential. Like originally that song was about bartenders. Like, the first couple lines. You lit my cigarette, you stole my lighter, you overserved me, then you cut me off.
Okay.
It's literally about bartenders.
Yes.
So I started making a list of everything bartenders have ever done to me.
Or for you.
Or for me.
Yes.
And it started to get a little darker, a little deeper. And those things are all things that have been done to me or for me mm-hmm. by a bartender. But, you know, I've also been in love with some bartenders. So it also turned into...
By the way, that could be a dangerous game. Falling in love with a bartender. I've done it myself.
But as someone who's also a bartender, it's kind of a, it's kind of like the hazard of dating other musicians. I've dealt with the hazard of both dating other musicians and dating my fellow bartenders.
Let's talk about some of those hazards.
It's
sort of maybe the Dukes of Hazzards, right?
Yes, there have been some very... not quite getaways scenes, I think.
Okay, so let's keep talking about the song, and then we will, I want to get to whatever we get to, right? Some interesting, fun stuff. But so when you write these lyrics, right, so you the first two lines or whatever had happened, you're like, that could be a song, cool. So then you start, like, working with other things. You remember, like, or you think of images or little points to sort of reiterate a theme or something like that. And then probably sometimes you get something, you're like, that's no good, and you get rid of it, right?
Yeah, there's probably 3 pages of potential lyrics for that song.
Uh-huh.
I think that particular song, I believe, actually started, I think I thought it was going to be a poem. And poems are a lot different from songs. A lot of people think that if you write poetry, you could write songs, or vice versa. And I think that they're 2 very different animals, but I've always written poetry. I think I thought that one was going to be a poem. Mm-hmm. And then it got a little sing-songy, and then I realized it was, in fact, a song.
It's hard to read song lyrics like I just did. I hope it's better if you sing it.
Yes.
Is that one of the things that tells you the difference between a poem and a song?
Definitely. And in fact, I was just talking to someone about this yesterday, because when I first started writing songs, I had been writing poetry for several years. And that's what I thought I wanted to do, was write poetry. When I started performing, it was like the era of the slam poetry, and spoken word was like really hip mm-hmm. in the like mid to late 90s. And that was what I did long before I sang in front of people, was write and perform poetry. And a lot of my earliest songs, I think one of the things that makes them so terrible is that they were poems that I tried to just set to music. And they didn't work as songs. They worked just fine as poems, but as songs, they didn't really work.
Can you say, if somebody's listening and they're like, you know, a lot of people are trying to improve their songwriting skills, or I like want to do it, or what's the difference? Can you put that into words?
I think, like what you were saying a minute ago about trying to read song lyrics, they don't come out right. They don't sound like a poem. They just sound like you're reading song lyrics. And so I feel like if I can't read it, if I can't put a cadence to it, then it's not a poem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, with music, with melody, you can turn words and you can do anything.
True. With like, for phrasing, for example, you could shove more syllables into a scent or a line if it works, right? But it doesn't have to. Yeah, you're right. There's a different meter, a different rhythm to it, right? Or you have more options.
Right. And, you know, not that I was ever a poet that did, you know, that wrote like poetry in a traditional sense. Like I didn't write in certain styles of poetry, but even just stuff that was very free form, it still worked to just speak it. And most of my song lyrics, I don't think work as a poem now. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was just looking back at some of my old songs, my first songs that I ever wrote. And they were definitely poems that I tried to just, you know, add music to.
Don't you hate it when people shove bad lyrics into a song?
Yeah, and in fact, on the way here, there's this, I'm not going to name names. I really like pop country music a lot, which is something not a lot of people know about me.
Wow.
I really like top 40 country.
Fun fact.
Because the musicianship
is... Are you going to Taste of Country here in Buffalo?
I am not. I don't really go to large concerts,
I wonder what
though.
That actually tastes like, Taste of Country.
I think it tastes like beer.
Fine. I like it
and,
so far.
And
don't say rodeos, because I'm against rodeos.
Okay. I think it tastes like dirt roads.
That's okay.
And moonlight.
Oh, that's great. I think I'm going to go. Okay, so anyway, sorry.
On my way here, there was this, there's a country hit that's on the radio right now, and I like the song, and I like the musicianship is stellar. That's what I like about country music is the musicianship is always really, really top-notch. And the dude can sing, but there is this line in this song that is so terrible, and I just want to be like, dude, you really couldn't spend an extra hour in the writer's room. The line
Please
is about like.
Give me the line. Can you do know it?
Well, the song is called One Number Away.
Okay.
And the idea is that, you know, I miss you and I want to call you. And, you know, I've basically got my finger on the dial. Like I'm about to like call you.
Right.
But the line is like, does the smoke in your mirrors something? I've blocked it out already, but it's about like smoke.
I'll look it up.
And mirrors and does the smoke. It's terrible.
It stands out, right?
Because the whole song is such a nice song, and the line has no meaning whatsoever. It's about, you know, he's saying to the girl, like, are you driving around cranking our favorite song, you know, thinking of me? But then it's like, does the smoke in your mirrors get something? It's just bad.
Yeah, we'll
it's
have just, to look that one up.
It's really, really bad.
Okay, so I'm going to look that up while we keep talking.
Okay.
While you answer my next question, which is this. Why do you still love music? You've been through a lot. We've been through a lot. 20 years.
Yes.
We've seen a lot. We've done a lot, right?
Mm.
If you look at the cost-benefit analysis, right? Is there still more benefit than cost?
Yeah, like I'm alive, you know? Like I'm alive. And I don't know if I would have made it without music. I mean, not to be super melodramatic, but...
That's huge.
I mean, that's what I live for still. It's really sometimes, other than my dog, it's kind of my only reason to...
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And I know I'm smiling right now, but like it's kind of a, sometimes it's a sad fact because like I have never had any success musically.
That's not true.
Well,
that's one of our topics.
I haven't had monetary success.
That's probably
I
true.
I still have a day job. I'll always have a day job, most likely. I mean, and I don't hate my day job, but it's not what I would have chosen for myself if I had realized that I was never going to have any musical success. But at the same time, if I had chosen something else again, I don't think I would be alive.
And that, by the way, that's part of one of the reasons I want to do this podcast is because this idea of financial success in doing music is such an anomaly. Everything I've learned about it, like there's this one period of time from like the 50s, Elvis, let's start with Elvis, up until now, and some, you know, the one... percent, right? It's there, but before that musicians really didn't make money,
right?
So and we had this there's so much we could talk about, but when I got into it, the one thing I thought about was that carrot that you follow.
Yes.
But the whole time you're doing the following is really when it's happening and that you're really living the life of a musician,
right?
And you know, I think you have had a lot of success, and I would certainly I have more things to point out to you about that. But I think that, yeah, the financial part is what really bothers me, because there's not been a pay raise for, you know, working in bars, working in clubs in 30 years.
Yeah, ever. Not in the whole time I've been playing.
Right. Here's the line. Verse one. Are you stuck at a red light with a Marlboro light on your lips? First of all, I see a couple problems in there.
Yeah, not the best.
Does the smoke in your mirror get clearer without my kiss?
See, that's a terrible line. It doesn't make any metaphor. It doesn't work. I don't know what he's going for there, but that image doesn't work in any way.
Let's call that other Catherine Cook and see what she knows.
See what she thinks about it.
Okay. Okay, so success, you. I have another. Okay, here we go. I also looked this up. Like, so let's think about this. First of all the reviews that are online about you as a solo performer and you with Redheaded Stepchild and you in Black Rocks, Idaho, and you with the Healing Committee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Powerhouse vocals. Powerful vocals. I didn't print out the actual quotes, but everything just talks about what I know about you. Your freaking voice is amazing. And the way you convey your songs, which are already so good, is just important. Okay. I think it's, so let's look at, let me just see. 96, we talked about Redhead Stepchild, 96 to 2010.
Yeah, just about.
You lived here in Buffalo. You're from here. And then you moved to Nashville for how many years did you?
I think we were there for 8 years.
Okay, and we could talk about that if we want to or need to. But when you moved back here to Buffalo, now you are with, you started with Black Rocks, Idaho, doing your own stuff. You're thinking about doing a solo album, and you continue to write. Okay, let's see, Suwannee Spring Fest 4 times.
Yeah,
Magnolia Festival. 3 times, Blue Heron, Great Blue Heron, 3 times, Barnyard Folk Fest, 9 times, OUR Festival, Allentown Art Festival, 9 times, the Apple Umpkin Fest. Wow.
That was a great little festival. Okay. I think it still happens every year.
Apple Umpkin.
The Apple Umpkin.
See, you know how Blue Heron, they're always like, Happy Heron. Yeah. And like by the third day, you just want to punch the next person that says that to you. But do they say that at the Apple Umpkin Fest? Happy Apple Umpkin.
I wish that they did, because it kind of has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? Happy
it does.
Apple. Happy Apple Umpkin.
Blues in the Valley, East Providence Heritage Fest, Dayton Blues Fest. Is that Dayton, Florida?
No, that's Dayton, Ohio. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Daytona.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, see. I'm not going to start a geography podcast. Don't worry. Blues in the Valley. Oh, I did that. The Dam Show.
That was a great show.
Where is it? Is
that
on the
still
dam?
Happens. It is. It's in Austin, Pennsylvania. It's the Austin Dam, which is a dam that actually burst like in the, I want to say the 20s. And a lot of people died, I think. But they created a park, a memorial park where the dam was. And they throw shows there now. And they do late shows onto the old ruins of the dam.
Oh, cool.
And the stage is right in front of it. And it's a really great festival. The last year that we played that was 2009. It still goes on. I just saw it come up in my on my Facebook today. It's mm-hmm. in August.
That sounds pretty good. You're sure there's no water behind it, right?
There's some water, but it's not.
It's not like.
It's just a creek now.
Which leads me into my next thing, Cape Fear Fair. Cape Fear. Wasn't that a movie with Robert De Niro?
It sure
as
was.
A remake of the 1950s
yes,
movie?
Yes, he was neither of those,
was
none
he
of those people
in your
were
band
there.
At that time?
No.
Okay.
But that was the last time I ever went on a amusement park ride.
Oh,
was
really?
At that festival.
Why?
Because I threw my back out and realized, in fact, I was with my good friend Rebecca, who you also know because she used to play in your band.
Yeah, I met her a couple times.
You might have met her. She might be on one of your records. And she played in Redheaded Stepchild, and we were together at that festival, and it was like a county fair kind of thing, and they gave us ride tickets as part of our compensation.
Yes.
So Rebecca and I went on all the rides, and we went on like that thing, it's like the pirate, you know, where it like swings back and forth.
The big giant ship.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it looks like it's moving slowly.
Yeah.
Right.
And there was a woman sitting next to me wearing too much perfume. And by the time we got off the ride, I had thrown out my back and thought I was going to throw up.
Oh.
And Rebecca felt similarly to me. And we said, okay, we are now too old for
officially, yes,
amusement park rides. I think we were about all of 30 then. Oh, but
darn it. Cause I was going to invite you to go with me to the Erie County Fair this year.
I think I'd still get on the Ferris wheel, perhaps.
Okay. Yeah. It's a date. We'll do it.
Okay.
So, I mean, honestly, so many gigs. You had how many years that you guys just toured all around the country?
For a good 5 or 6 years, that was what we were doing pretty much all the time. I mean, we would go out for a month, be back in Buffalo for a few weeks, go out for a couple months, be back in Buffalo. Sometimes we would headquarter out of our friend's house in North Carolina. We had another friend in Florida that we would kind of use as a home base. And tour around those regions for weeks.
By the way, on those early years, no GPS.
Right.
No internet.
No.
Like, how different was it?
It was, you know, I have to say that obviously it's easier now. But at the same time, there was something to touring that having to physically send press kits to the local papers and the local radio stations, and having to have a physical mailing list where we sent physical actual postcards to hundreds of people every month.
Yeah.
All of that kind of did build a little excitement. It's a lot easier to get attention now, but because it's so easy, a lot of things I think get lost in the shuffle. We really built, not just us, but all the bands of that era, we were building grassroots connections to people, to venues, to press.
Yeah.
They were personal relationships. And now everything seems a little more anonymous. And of course, it's also flooded the market with people who aren't that great, but they've got a laptop and a you know.
Sort of like me with this podcast.
Exactly.
Right?
Now any idiot can do it.
No, I absolutely know what you're saying, and I think about that a lot because, you know, this whole do-it-yourself sort of career for musicians, songwriters, it is true that you can. You don't have that barrier of the record label and
right.
the booking and that perception. You don't have that barrier anymore. But also everything a record label did for us is not there anymore. On the level of, like, the working musician. You
right.
know what I mean? Like, and there's such value to what they did as well, which is, like, do all of that. Have the plan. Have the promotion. Book the tour. You know, if you had booking agents working
See,
for
we
you.
Actually never had any of that. We did 100% of everything on our own. We never had any help. We never hired anyone. We never had management. We never had a label. We never had a booking agent. We never had song pluggers.
Wow, you guys did amazing, really, because you covered a lot of ground.
I have to say it was mostly, I will say, my partner in that band, David Nanny, worked tirelessly. His only goal in life, really, was to uplift us and to get us going and keep us going. Mm-hmm. And really he wanted me to be successful. He was really trying to promote me and our brand, and he worked very, very, very hard at it.
Well, it takes that. I think it takes somebody or people. You guys all worked really hard, and you were committed. You were like all in, 100%. That was your life, right?
Yeah.
And it takes that.
Yeah, I mean, anything less, I mean, honestly, it's really just that we couldn't be four people. You know, if we could have been four people, you know, we could have done even a lot more than we did. David, basically, it was his full-time job for the years that we were touring constantly. I was picking up waitressing shifts every minute that we weren't on the road to keep the money coming in when we weren't playing. Because the only way for us to pay any of our bills was to be constantly moving, constantly playing. But when we went out, we would try to play every single night if we could.
Yeah.
And that included playing totally free gigs because maybe we'd sell a few CDs. It meant busking if we had to, if we were broke, to try to sell a few CDs and make a few bucks to put in the gas tank. Our whole band at one point lived together in a house that we owned that we bought for $5,000 cash.
Wow.
And everyone lived there. Nobody made a salary. Everything went into the band. That's what it took, because we didn't have management or label support. Yeah. It was the only way we could do it. And it made sense to us at the time. And it was really great for a long time. It really, really worked.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about Sister Rosetta Tharpe in just a few minutes, but you were just living the life that so many other people lived in history. You're living the life of a working musician.
Yes.
Right? And that's a success in itself.
That's true. I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, I certainly wish we had gone a little further with our career with that band, because I think we are a good little band. But at the same time, I know that maybe the other Catherine Cooks you found, maybe they wouldn't want to trade with me. But there's plenty of people that wish that they could have done the stuff that I did or that you've done musically.
Yeah, there's something about it, right? Don't you think still? Like, what is it about this thing that we do that there's a mystique or a pull, or what is it?
Yeah, you know, even now at some of these littler gigs that I play now, I play a lot of, you know, pretty casual small shows. There's still people who come up to me and wish that they had the guts to get up in front of people, for instance, or wish that they had kept up with those piano lessons when they were a kid, or wish that they could write out the things that they were feeling. And I feel really lucky that I could do all that stuff, that I did keep up with the lessons as a kid, that I did keep writing down the things that I was feeling, that I never was scared to get up in front of people and sing. I mean, I feel it when I see other musicians. I mean, there's plenty of people that I watch and I think, oh, I wish I could do that. That's amazing.
I think about this for a second. I ask everybody about this. Music is so ubiquitous now. Live music. It's everywhere. It's in the coffee shop. It's in the grocery store. And I'm talking live music.
Yes, it is in the grocery store.
It's in every restaurant or bar. Like, does that devalue it? Isn't there something to be said for it's harder to get to? Like, it's less opportunities for less people, but that feeling of going into a music club and you're going there for the music and that's your night out. It's not like, oh, we're going to eat, we're going to be working on our phones, we're going to have some drinks, we're going to meet friends, and then there's a band there.
Like, I'm not sure if it devalues it necessarily, because I think there are still plenty of real music venues. I think there's a difference between going to the brewery that also has a band that night, and maybe you didn't even have to pay a cover, and maybe they're kind of just a background noise. I don't think that changes the fact that people will still also pay a cover to go somewhere like Sportsman's Tavern or another like true music venue. I don't know if it really changes the fact that, like, when I do go to a music venue to see music, you know, people are quiet and they are paying attention and they have paid that $10 to go and see that band. I like that there's opportunities for people to play. I don't always want to play at some of those venues where I'm just going to be background noise. I've turned down even paying gigs where I knew that the audience was not going to be there to see me.
Why? Is that because of a particular mood you're in or era? Or is it because you don't need the money? Or why do you turn that down?
A little of all of that. When I used to be in, like, the bands I've been in that are party bands, I'm fine with whether or not people are necessarily there to see me. But my solo project, which I've been really concentrating on, it's lyric driven and it's not party music and it's not background music. And I don't do cover tunes unless it's a song I feel like I'm inspired to do. Mm-hmm. I would never, I'm just not that there's anything wrong with people who want to do that, but I'm not interested in being a human jukebox. Like, it's just not for me. So I find that if I play gigs that aren't real music venues, I get a lot more people saying, play this song, or do you know any Janis, or can you, you know, and I just don't want to deal with that. Mm-hmm. I'd rather pick up a shift waiting tables than have people questioning why I'm not doing any Joni Mitchell tunes.
Dude, I'm so with you on that. I get you. I get that.
I want to play my originals. So I want to play at venues where people are expecting to see that. That's what they're there for. And I don't need people to be super quiet and listen to every word. But mm-hmm. I want to feel like I do want to feel like my music has value to me. Like, because again, the only reason I'm still doing this is for love. I'm not doing this because the paycheck is amazing or because I'm super famous and I've got to go out and play my hits. I do this because it's my passion, my life. So I would rather play less gigs that are meaningful, like quality over quantity at this point.
Does the smoke in your mirror get clearer without my kiss?
I just don't get that line. Does it make any sense to you?
This is definitely not one of those set of, I mean, I don't even know the song.
We'll have to give that song a listen at some point because I have to say, I don't know who the drummer is on this song, but it's my favorite it's currently my favorite drum track.
Okay.
Of any song on the radio.
Dude, that's sweet. Okay. We're going to take a little break.
Okay.
And this is the part I can just cut out if you don't want to talk about it, but I remember a story about you telling me when you were in Nashville and you saw Steve Martin.
I did.
Can you tell me?
I would love to tell that. Me and my ex had just broken up and we were trying to have an adult conversation and have closure, which you can never have. It's not a thing. And we were at one of the honky tonks in Nashville on Broadway and, he stormed out, and I stormed out the back door. There's an alley in between the honky tonks and the Ryman Auditorium, which is like the really famous mother church of country music.
Yes.
And Steve Martin was playing there that night with his bluegrass band, the Steep Canyon Rangers, who are awesome, by the
way.
Sweet.
Okay.
And I was sitting on the stage door steps of the Ryman Auditorium, crying my eyes out. And Steve Martin walked out the stage door and looked down at me and I looked at him and I said, "Hi, Steve Martin." And he was like, "Hello." And he kept moving because he is not stupid, because I would have wound up being like, "My boyfriend and I broke up and everything's terrible." But yes, that's my great celebrity encounter with Steve Martin.
That's a great story. And on that note, we'll be right back. Okay, we're back. I was just apologizing to Catherine that I don't have air conditioning up here in the podcast room.
Well, air conditioning is a great privilege that
was invented in Buffalo.
Was it invented right here in Buffalo, which I find a little ironic since this is mostly a cold city.
And also, I think I believe it, but right now I live in a town called Hamburg, New York, and guess what they say here? You can guess.
What do they say here?
They say they invented the hamburger.
See, I don't buy that.
And there's a movement to paint a freaking hamburger on the water tower.
Well, you know, I guess every town has to do what it can to differentiate itself from other towns.
If I wasn't so busy protesting against Donald Trump, I would be protesting against that hamburger on the water tower.
So after you have a successful Twitter war with our president, then you can start really concentrating on fighting
The hamburger. Yes.
Okay.
Part of the reason I'm doing this podcast is 2 points. One, to let everyone know, these friends that I've been lucky enough to know for 20 years that live the life of a musician, and I want to get to know them and their lives and their thoughts about the state of the music industry today. Part one. Part two is I want us to look at some people who came before us and who maybe a lot of people know about, but more people should know about. So, for example, Catherine and I, we're going to talk about Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Mm-hmm.
She was just this year inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
About time.
Let's talk about her, right? I have some notes, and then hopefully you can interject as needed or as wanted. Sister Rosetta Tharpe is credited by many as one of the precursors to rock and roll. She was the first great recording star in the genre of gospel, even before Mahalia Jackson, right? So that's interesting. We could talk about that. She influenced Chuck Berry, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Elvis Presley. She was one of the first people to use distortion on her electric guitar, which I personally love.
That's amazing.
Yes. She was born March 20th, 1915, in Cotton Plant, Arkansas.
Wow. That must have been a depressing place to grow up. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say that.
In 1915, if you're black, I would imagine, yes, yeah, for sure. Her parents were both cotton pickers. That was their job.
Right.
But her mother, so her mother, they say, is Katie Bell Newbin was her mother's name. And her father, there's not much about him, so I don't even have his name here. They only said he was also known as a singer. But Rosetta's mother was also a singer, mandolin player. You like that?
Oh, wow.
An evangelist. She was a preacher for the Church of God in Christ, which encouraged rhythmic musical expression, dancing in praise, and allowing women to preach in the church.
Oh, that's kind of amazing.
Right. So if you think about it, so here's her mother, chooses this church, she can preach, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of sets the tone for everything Rosetta did. Rosetta Tharpe was singing and playing guitar at the age of 4 in churches, right? Do you want to take a break? Or are you good?
No, I'm good.
Do you need a beer?
Yes. Yeah.
I'll keep talking.
Clearly, I need a beer.
Rosetta was playing the guitar at age 4. Like, just let that sink in for a minute.
I mean, I was playing Barbie at age 4.
I was playing Ken at age 4. Which is true. I had mod hair Ken, and it just about, I almost died of happiness when I got, because my sister got Barbie and I got mod hair Ken. And he had little mustaches and sideburns you could pull off and
really?
Stick to his face.
I don't remember that.
He had real
all.
Hair, not the painted on hair.
Wow.
Okay. So she was already recognized as a bit as a musical prodigy, okay? And it's interesting, at the age of 6, her mother, for whatever reason, became a traveling evangelist. Probably, she said, I'm going to get the hell out of Cotton Plant, Arkansas, right? If you're from Cotton Plant, please write us a letter or post, give us information about your town. We're not trying to diss it, right?
Right. Like, no offense to the, I'm sure, fine people of Cotton Plant, Arkansas.
Right. Of course. Yeah. But they left and they started traveling and they ended up in, well, first they ended up in Chicago. Okay. She traveled with her mother during that time and she was billed as a singing and guitar playing miracle. It was all sermon, part gospel music, gospel concerts across the South. Then it says they, in the mid-20s, they landed in Chicago. Age 19, she married a guy named Thomas Thorpe, with an O. And she settled on a version of that name, Tharpe, for her own. She switched it, right? Hmm. And she accompanied her mother on many of the tours. Her mother and her husband, it looks like, was also a preacher. Okay, so the husband accompanied her and her mother on their tours. The marriage, surprisingly, only lasted a few years, but she decided to adopt a version of her husband's surname for her stage name. So one thing that I want to talk about with you is one thing she was, and her mother was willing to cross the line between secular and spiritual music that caused some problems for Sister Rosetta. Do you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah, well, I remember reading years ago when I first became aware of her, well, probably 20 years ago is when I first became aware of her, that she had gotten a lot of flack from church members for playing to secular audiences and for playing to white audiences.
Okay, that brings this up. Guess where she played? She moves to New York City. She's 23 years old. She starts playing at the Cotton Club wow. in New York City with Lucky Millinder. Now, isn't that a good music name?
Yes.
So he's like a band leader. He's got a band, and she sings. The videos I saw, she's singing. She's not playing her guitar right. in the beginning. But she's singing songs. One of them that was kind of a hit for them was called, hold on. You know I'm just going to have to pull this part out. I'm going to edit this particular part, but Tall Skinny Papa. That's the name of her hit song. And she sings about how she wants a tall, skinny papa. And her nightclub performances, in which she would sometimes sing gospel songs amid scantily clad showgirls, which I wish I could get into a time machine and go back to the yes. Cotton Club and hear that right now. Oh, my gosh. Caused her to be shunned by some in the gospel community.
And, you know, that still happens today. Look at the, like, Sacred Steel players, Robert Randolph or the Campbell Brothers. They play this amazing, like, gospel. I don't know if you're familiar with Sacred Steel.
No. I know the Randolph Brothers, like...
So that music comes out of a specific Christian sect that features like slack key guitar. And
what's that?
Well, like Hawaiian style guitar.
Sweet. Okay.
Which then morphed into pedal steel style for a lot of these church members. And then a lot of these church members started playing at like hippie festivals basically and got shunned by their churches. And
so you're saying that still,
that's still a thing, like that if you're a church musician, you're going to catch some trouble for going out and playing that music to secular audiences. In fact, this drummer locally that I work with a lot, he makes most of his living off church gigs. He plays in the church bands every Sunday, plays like two or three services a week. And there are some members of those communities that don't like that he goes out and plays with rock bands on the weekends.
Hmm, still.
So that's still, there's still a disconnect. And in fact, years and years ago with my old band, we once played this very small festival in Butler, Georgia. And at the time, I mean, we were a secular band, but we were covering a few gospel songs. Like we were doing Wayfaring Stranger and we were doing I Am a Pilgrim. And Down by the Riverside, songs I still love and still love to perform. And some very sweet church ladies came up to me after the set and said, you know, it's really inappropriate for you to be doing praise music and then to be doing this music that's very sexually suggestive. And and you really shouldn't do that.
No kidding.
And that was, you know, 10 years ago. So I can't imagine what Sister Rosetta Tharp was going through in the 30s,
yeah.
Trying to bridge that gap as a woman, as a black woman, as a black church-going woman, as a black woman who played electric guitar, which you play electric guitar, you know, even today, people are going to make judgments about you as a woman playing an instrument.
I mean, right?
Still.
Isn't that crazy?
I'm sure there's still men who try to snag your amp out of your hand and carry it for you when you're going into gigs.
That's true. Is that a bad thing? No.
You know what? Today, I would let someone carry
my
amp.
Oh my God, now I got to think about that. Let me just digest that one.
So for her to have done what she was doing in that era was pretty progressive.
Yes, let me say one thing about that. Her mother was with her every step of the
That's
way.
That's amazing.
That's huge. The power of acceptance, right, from your parent or somebody. Like, so she had somebody that she obviously didn't, she wasn't shunned by everybody, right? And that's part one. And part two, I think the form or the branch of that Christianity that they were in, which is like you can sing and dance in church, right?
Right.
And women can be preachers. That's, you can stop right there.
Right.
Right? That probably says everything right there.
Yeah, that was not probably typical of the era.
Right. And even now.
Even now.
Okay. So, let's go. But she did say, some of her friends actually said that she sang those secular songs because she had a contract with this guy, Lucky Millinder, and they were friends. They were getting, he didn't have her like in this Bengali sort of relationship, but she was contractually obligated to play what he told her, or to sing what he told her to sing. We can go online and you can see videos of her singing some of these, this train, Rock Me, Tall Skinny Papa, super cool videos. She did that through the 30s. Then World War II. Okay, this is interesting too. She recorded during World War II, and she was only one of two gospel artists able to record V-discs for troops overseas.
Oh, wow.
Her song Strange Things Happening Every Day was recorded in 1944. And that song, you should actually play that song. Man, that's kick-ass.
I don't think I know that
still
one.
Still so relevant. Strange Things Happening Every Day. It was a boogie-woogie beat. That's when that sort of showcased her guitar playing on vinyl. Like, so everyone's... She already was known as a guitarist, but this, like, sort of sealed the deal. And so, from what I understand, I think she actually played some overseas shows for the troops. I don't know 100%. Somebody could correct me if I'm wrong, but she was in a very select group of people doing this kind of music during the war.
Hmm.
Okay? So this song... Strange Things Happening Every Day was the first gospel song to make Billboard's Harlem Hit Parade, later known as Race Records, then R&B, okay, the top 10. So this was the first gospel song to make that hit top 10. This 1944 record has been credited by some as being the first rock and roll record.
Wow.
She toured throughout the 1940s, backed by various gospel quartets, including a group called the Dixie Hummingbirds, who was like her backing group for a while. This is the part I wanted to get to. In 1946, she's playing at a concert, or she goes to a concert hall. She's not performing. She goes to see Mahalia Jackson, who I would love to do a show on her, right?
Yes.
It's in New York City. And she sees a woman singing there named Marie Knight. Okay. It says here, whatever the source I got, Tharp recognized a special talent in Knight. I think she recognized something a little more because 2 weeks later, she shows up at Marie Knight's door, invites her to go on the road. They start touring together. Everyone starts talking. They're in a sexual relationship. They're in love, right? They tour. And they sing so great together. You got to hear Up Above My Head is one of their songs they recorded together. Oh, my. It's a gospel song, right? So here, but that puts a whole other new twist on things, right? So they go on the road, and they travel for... They always denied having a relationship, but it was sort of like one of those unspoken things that kind of everybody knew about, right? But neither here nor there, they were best friends. And they toured together until 1950, 4 years, when Marie's two small children were killed in a house fire at her mother's house back in New Jersey. So Marie Knight lost her kids in the house fire. And that sort of, they sort of stopped performing together and touring together at that point. It says this event effectively halted the careers of the two women as a duo, obviously.
Wow.
Right? So Rosetta Tharpe, so it was in 1950. 1951, some manager, I don't know if it was a manager or a promoter, like, because she was doing so well with Marie Knight that she's like, all right, now what do I do? A year later, 1951, somebody tells her, these two promoters say, hey, we have an idea. Let's have you get married at Griffith Baseball Stadium in Washington, D.C. So she's like, all right. So they find a guy to marry her. His name was Russell Morrison. And they promote it. And 25,000 people come to the wedding at this baseball stadium.
Oh, my God.
Listen, remember, why don't we think about this?
Right?
Note to self. I'm actually ordained minister. I could marry you. Let's think of somebody, all right?
Let's find some sucker to...
Yes. Okay, so she gets, and they bring her wedding gifts, like 20,000 people. Like some of the numbers, some people say 15,000, some say 20, some say 25. They all pay admission to go to see her get married, and it happened right at the pitcher's mound. She walks from the pitcher's mound to home plate, like that's down the aisle. And guess who her best, what do they call it, maid of honor? Guess who her maid of honor is?
Who was her maid of honor?
Marie Knight.
Oh, wow.
Her friend. Isn't that amazing? They get married. It was her third marriage. So, It wasn't Russell Morrison. His name was not that. That was her manager. The guy she married was named Forrest Allen. Okay. So then they had a concert. Then she sang the concert. Her marriage didn't last that long.
Weird.
The concert was recorded, and you can buy a record. It's like $115. You can get a copy of that record on eBay. I checked.
Oh.
You can hear the whole ceremony and the concert. Isn't that cool?
That's an interesting gimmick.
Yes.
Yeah.
We should think about that.
We should.
Worst case scenario.
We'll put that on the list.
Yes. Okay, a couple more things here. So through the 50s, she played a lot. She gave Little Richard his first chance to be on the stage besides being in a church. She heard him singing before a concert, and she called him up on stage to sing with her. And she actually paid him afterwards, and he credits her as the reason he wanted to do that professionally.
That's incredible.
Right? So, 1963, somebody sets her up on a tour of Europe with Muddy Waters. And this is that famous video. You can go online and see if her
singing. Like, she's at, like, the train depot?
The train station, mm-hmm. Yeah. Some promoter in England. And by the way, you know, England, they sort of, like, appreciated the roots music that,
yes.
Meanwhile, in America, wasn't being appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were a lot of American musicians that were pretty much living in Europe because they could make a living playing music.
Yeah.
Because Europe, especially the British, were really, really into roots music at that time.
Yeah. So, similar situation. This tour, you could look it up. There's a whole video about it. It's with Muddy Waters and a whole bunch of other people. They bring her in on the train. It was actually raining, but she, and the storm, like, so one half of the platform, they bring all these kids in on a bus. The other half of the platform, they have the, or a train, I'm sorry. The other half of the platform, they have the band set up. They bring her in on a carriage, horse-drawn carriage. She gets off.
And she's wearing, like, a fur coat,
wearing a coat.
Yeah.
Plugs in her electric guitar and starts jamming.
Starts shredding.
Didn't it rain? Okay. So a lot of people think that it was in Manchester, England. And many people think that this is where people like Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, Keith Richards, she influenced them. And so she was appreciated in this setting. Okay. It says she was often given backhanded compliments. They said she could play like a man, and that was a good thing. Whereas she could actually play better than a lot of men, right?
Well, like, don't people still treat a lot of female musicians that way? I mean,
I personally heard that a lot, and to be perfectly honest, I took it as a compliment back in the day. You know, like, I thought you were a guy playing. You sound like a guy,
yeah,
right?
I spent a long time being really offended by that kind of thing. Like, I play harmonica, and apparently there aren't a lot of women who play harmonica. And I used to get really offended when people would say, I've never heard a girl play harmonica like that. And then I went through a phase where I took it as a compliment. And now it's starting to offend me again.
Yeah, I think so, because guess what? The younger girls, women that come behind us, like, think of my own nieces, they don't put up with any shit. They don't put up with any of the shit we put up with.
No.
And we didn't even know we were putting up with it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I actually got into it recently with a man who's a drummer who claims that women are just not predisposed to play the drums.
Seriously?
And I said, do you think maybe it's because every time they play the drums, they're called a female drummer? Like,
as opposed to a drummer?
Because we were talking about this woman locally who plays drums, who's very good. And this male drummer was like, I saw this great female drummer. And I was like, do you mean you saw this great drummer? And he was like, well, you know why there's no women drummers. It's because it's just not, women just aren't predisposed to it.
What the?
And I said, you know, it's not like menstruation, right? It's not like something only girls can do or only boys can do. Like, maybe the reason there aren't female drummers is because they don't want to be called female
drummers. Yeah.
Yeah.
So back to Rosetta. She did get her due, as you know. Well, actually, she did, but she, after she died, She was only 58 years old when she passed away. Complications from diabetes. And it was 3 years after her mother passed away. I found that interesting because every time she toured throughout Europe and everywhere, her mother was with her. So when she did pass away at the age of 58 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, this is going to kill you. Marie Knight did her hair and makeup and picked her clothes.
Oh.
Right.
Wow.
Back here in the United States in 1998, the U.S. Postal Service did a commemorative stamp to honor her. It's part of a series on legends of, it was blues and gospel, right? So she's got a stamp. In 2008, a concert was held to raise funds to pay for a marker for her grave. And January 11th in 2008 was declared Sister Rosetta Tharpe Day in Pennsylvania. A gravestone was put in place later that year.
The idea that she didn't have a gravestone.
Right? Doesn't that kind of say it all right there?
Yeah.
What the hell? What the fuck?
But, you know, that's how we've treated a lot of our incredible musicians without whom things like rock and roll wouldn't exist. Like, you and I wouldn't be playing music if some of these musicians hadn't existed.
Yes.
Didn't the same thing happen to Memphis Minnie? Didn't the same thing happen to, like, so many, like, great pioneers, especially women in music?
And that's what I'm saying. Like, for you to say that you don't think you've been successful in music, well, she could have said the same thing.
Right.
And what a terrible thing to say, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because I ask myself these questions sometimes, like, how do we as a society value the arts? I just don't know why we have to grow up feeling like we have to apologize for the fact that we're not on, you know, in stadiums.
Right.
You know, like, why? Or why do we have to apologize for the fact that I'm 53 years old and I want to keep rocking, right? Like, why? How could that possibly be a bad thing? But I think we're trained as a culture. This is a problem. This is like, wait, why don't you just get over it? Move on, right? Why?
I wish I had an answer to that. I wish that at my day job, I wasn't asked, like, you know, don't you want to, like, go back to school? Or don't you want to have a real job? Or how long do you think you can keep playing gigs? And it's like, nobody asked the Rolling Stones how long they can keep playing gigs.
Right.
Just because I play in a 100 capacity corner bar instead of a 100,000 capacity stadium, like, what's really the difference? What's really the difference? I mean, the Rolling Stones sure don't have to do it for the paycheck. Like, there's a reason that they still want to get on stage. They don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have to get on stage. I don't have to get back on stage. But
that's so true.
But I want to. I want to get on stage. I want to play music. And my voice is stronger now than it ever was when I was in my youth.
Isn't that, there's some cool things about maturing, like growing. You're a lot younger than me, so I'm
10 years growing. Younger than you. That's
not
that
crazy.
You're
getting older.
But you know, I'm 43, so I mean, by anyone's definition, that's not a kid.
By my definition,
I think I'm a much better musician now than I was in my 20s. I'm definitely a better singer. I have more range. I have more control. I have more dynamics. I have maturity. I am a better listener. I'm a better communicator with my bandmates.
Mm-hmm. That's important, right?
That's really important. I don't know if I really, I think I struggled a lot when I was younger to convey my musical ideas to people I played with or to understand where they were coming from. I think I have a much better grasp of the mechanics of a song. I'm more intuitive now. I definitely have a way better ear. I can do things. I can literally do things now that I couldn't do 20 years ago. I can harmonize. I can sing really good harmonies. I never did that when I was young. I do that now because I sing backup for a really amazing singer, Alan Whitney, who I have to have good chops to be able to sing with him because he's such a good singer. There are definitely things I can do now that I couldn't do when I was young. And yet youth is what's so favored and so valued, even in the arts, which makes no sense because, you know, again, no one would tell a 43-year-old painter that, like, their prime is over and they've plateaued out. And I don't, and no one would tell a famous musician that they should stop playing because they're 40 or they're 50 or they're 60 or they're 70. There's no retirement age. I mean, Doc Watson played until he was 90. Why shouldn't I?
Do you remember ever getting good advice from anybody about being a, you know, performer or anything? Like, did you ever get any advice that, that helped you?
I got a lot of, I would say so. I would say I got good advice when I was young about even just simple things like professionalism. I don't think I was super professional when I was young, like, you know, like drinking too much on stage, for instance. I think I got some good advice about, you know, you sound better if the audience is drunk, but not if you're drunk. Things like that. I think I got some good lessons on practical matters like that. And I think I got some good advice about being more careful with my voice. I was kind of a shouter and a belter when I was young.
Sort of like full throttle all the time.
And I was told, like, you know, you're going to burn your voice out. And I did a few times. I kind of, you know, was probably pretty bad for like an entire tour because I shot my voice, you know, with the belting. I think I have a lot more control now. I think I did get a lot of good advice from older musicians. I was lucky because living in Buffalo, as you know, there's a lot of great musicians here. And when I was in my early 20s, I was fortunate enough to be friends with some great local musicians who were older than me, who gave me some, who did give me some good advice and things like that. And I got a lot of advice that was total bullshit, of course. You know, dress better, be prettier, don't gain weight. When I moved to Nashville, I was told things like never be seen smoking a cigarette because people won't take you seriously.
But wait a minute. Hold on. Does the smoke in your mirror get clear without my kiss? Are you stuck at a red light with a Marlboro light on your lips?
Well, she's not a singer, though. She's the subject of the protagonist's angst, so.
Oh, really? Well, I mean, I guess I, from a practical standpoint, I could see why, as a singer, smoking is not one, is not beneficial to you. But they were talking about, like,
you'll just look bad. It'll look bad. The optics will be bad.
All right.
And,
so let's talk about Nashville for 1 minute.
Like, okay.
I've never lived there. I've been there. I've played there a couple times. Is it an environment that fosters creativity?
Yes and no. When I'm feeling good about my experience in Nashville, I would say yes. You can go to a writer's night every night of the week. You can be friends with people who are working the way you are, who are writing all the time, who are playing all the time. So that can be very inspirational. I personally am not good at like networking or that kind of stuff, but I think that in some ways it was beneficial. When I'm not feeling good about my Nashville experience, I say Nashville is where dreams go to die. But my personal story there is I moved down there with my partner, who was my bandmate, and we did not have the success we were looking for. And as the music fell apart, our relationship fell apart. So that's just my personal story. And that would have happened if we had gone to LA. That would have happened if we had gone to Austin. That would have happened if we had stayed in Western New York. So my own personal story, it clouds my perception of what my Nashville experience was like, for sure.
Probably for everybody,
and
right?
For a lot of people, I'm not the only person who went there and had their relationship fall apart. Because there's a lot of pressure to do better things. Also, you can't really get paid to play music in Nashville. Like, you can't really get any paid gigs in town, which was some, you know, the way we had lived for so long was constantly playing and supporting ourselves at least half the time through music, which we couldn't do there. So we still had to tour constantly, which meant we couldn't work on the Nashville connections. And then I wound up working a full-time job in a restaurant. And so I always say, well, I learned how to be a really great bartender in Nashville. I got really good at bartending. And, you know, it's an interesting city, and it's a friendly city, and it was a cool place to live. And I think everyone should live somewhere other than their hometown at some point in their life. So I'm glad that I did that. If I could go back, I might have picked a different city for us. I'm not sure if Nashville was really right for our music, but we gave it a shot.
Did you hear good music when you were there?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I heard a lot of really, really, really shitty music because everybody with a guitar and three chords thinks that they can go to Nashville and play shows.
Yeah, so that's one of the things is, like, the music is more powerful than any of the bullshit.
Yes.
Isn't that what, for me, that's what has always kept me in the game. I'm lucky enough to have a great band, right, that I've been with for so long, and I love them as people, and they're really good.
Yeah.
So that's half of it. The other half is something about the process of writing a song still has the power to put up with all of that other bullshit, because there's so much bullshit in this mm-hmm. field, right? I mean, you know, I mean, what other job do you have where you can go in and people clap for you, right? When you come in for your serving job, you clock in there, hey, right. Catherine, you're here. Nobody does that.
No.
But by the same token, what other job do you have where everyone feels like they can come up to you whenever they want and tell you everything you're doing wrong?
Yes.
Or what you should do.
Yes.
Or why you aren't doing it, or what happened to you, or why, whatever they think about you, they feel like they can say whatever they want to. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's all that. And for people who are, like, I'm an introvert. I think you probably are, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you're a musician, it's a weird line, because I can be extroverted, you know, and I can, obviously, you know, we can get up in front of people, no matter how many people. I mean, I get nervous before every show, but I'm not more nervous in front of 5,000 people than I am in front of 500 people or 50 people.
Right.
And once I start singing, like, I'm not nervous at all.
Right.
And I can bullshit with people after the show and, you know, thanks for coming. And yeah, this song's about this. And yes, this is where I get my ideas and mm-hmm. answer some of the stupid questions. Not that they're all stupid questions, but when I'm done, I'm done. And I'm ready to be home, and I don't go out very often, unless it is like to see one of my friends play music. Mm-hmm. But, you know, going back to like what we started this off with, like, music is what keeps me going and keeps me not just alive, but like happy to be alive. And I still, like, I know that I can do something that not everyone can do. And that's start with a line or a chord progression and take it all the way to playing a concert or making a record. And that is a really powerful
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, that's your thing, right?
Yeah,
that's
your what thing. I do.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Well, what you did was give me a really easy podcast interview, because that was so fun talking to you today.
Well, you and I have never had trouble talking.
Catherine, thank you.
Thank you, Allison.
Let's go out to eat.
Let's do it.
Okay. Thanks for listening to The Great Unsung. Please give us your feedback, your comments at thegreatunsung.com. Follow us on social media. Please subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts. This is Allison Pipitone. Thanks again.